Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith, author, leading global finance blogger, and philosopher, America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of 9 books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. His blog of twominds.com has logged over 55 million page views and is number 7 on CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. I'm always looking forward to our conversations.
Yeah, and today I thought we'd talk about the challenges of work, employment, and the prospects of what's been proposed recently by many of the developed countries, indebted developed countries at that, and that is namely on universal basic income. And you've graciously provided some charts to help lead the discussion as well on that.
Right. And this topic is very close to my heart and my interests, Richard. And I've written 2 books on universal basic income and alternatives to universal basic income. One is called A Radically Beneficial World, which lays out basically a program for guaranteed work and positive social roles, not just welfare for everyone, which is basically what universal basic income proposes. And my latest book, Money and Work Unchained, explores the importance of work and, again, positive social roles through work in the human psyche and the human spirit. And so we'll get to that, but that's my basic critique of universal basic income, is it doesn't really meet the needs of humans. It only solves the problem of how to provide enough consumption to keep people mm-hmm. from rebelling politically.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people are worried about trends in the economy, particularly what's happening in the form of software automation, robotics process automation, artificial intelligence. The idea being that maybe this is taking away jobs, and what are we going to do for work? Your thoughts on that, and if you can give some background on like how this discussion on UBI is taking place.
Right, right. Well, that's an excellent starting point, Richard. And let's talk about the problems that people recognize and that they hope universal basic income will solve. And of course, there's 2 big problems. One is the replacement of human labor by automation. And we see this, I have a couple of charts here about the participation rate in the United States, which is the number of working age people who are actually have jobs or are earning wages in the economy. And of course, this has been declining. And for men in particular, we see it's like a multi-decade trend down as the traditional economic sectors that men typically find employment in, such as construction and manufacturing, as those are in decline, then the male participation is declining even more significantly than the total workforce, including females. So that's definitely an issue. And then we have the other issue, which is inequality of wealth and income. And what we see is that for a variety of reasons, our economy is becoming a haves and have-nots. And we used to call there's a phrase called winner take all, and it's not so much winner take all, but it's winner take most. In other words, the top tier of our society is reaping the vast majority of the economic gains. And so I have some charts here that show like employment by age. older people are continuing to work because they can't afford to retire, while the number of middle-aged and younger people with jobs has stagnated for decades. And I have assets, median family assets chart here that shows that actually for the in terms of the median wealth of the household, it hasn't really recovered from the Great Recession of 2008-09. Now, the top 5% and 1% and 0.1%, they've done extremely well, in this last 9 years. But if we look at the average, wealth has actually stagnated or declined. And we see it here with this this chart of the income of percentage of the bottom 50% and the top 1%. And so the income of the bottom 50% has been sliding for years, while the income of the top 1% has been soaring. And so we all have to recognize, yes, these are two real problems. And this is why universal basic income is such an attractive solution for pundits and the political class and the leadership, because it seems to offer a solution to both rising inequality and the stagnation of jobs. But then that raises the question, okay, let's say that UBI of everybody receiving $1,000 a month or whatever the sum is going to be, is going to solve both these problems. Where is the money going to come from? And so, we can kind of just do some very rough numbers and we say, okay, this is for adults only, right? We're going to keep the programs for children and the elderly. This is for the working age populace, right? We're going to keep Social Security and Medicare for the elderly, and we're going to keep our child welfare and support programs for, infants and children. So what we're going to do is we're going to add about a trillion and a half, or possibly even $2 trillion of additional expense. And we're not really going to be able to save much, because the vast, working population, it doesn't really cost the government very much money at the moment. There's Medicaid and then some unemployment expenses and so on. But these are trivial amounts compared to the sums being spent on supporting the elderly and other government programs. So we're really going to have to add about $1.5 trillion to existing spending. And of course, I have some charts here that show, U.S. The national debt is on a tear. It's like doubling and tripling every few years, and it's roughly $20 trillion, right? It used to be under 10 a few short years ago. So, where are we going to be able to get this money? Are we going to be able to borrow it? And the answer is, well, if we borrow it, we're really putting pressure on the system such that we could break it. And I have a chart here that of China's debt, both private and state, and it's also soaring. So in other words, we need to be aware that this is a global problem. In other words, China and Japan, they're also facing a huge demographic change where their workforce is shrinking and their populace of elderly and retired is soaring. And that same is true of Europe. So globally, this is a problem for every government that's going to be supporting an expanding class of elderly and retirees, and it's providing UBI. It just doesn't compute, mm-hmm.
I was just going to ask. I mean, so what is the actual basic proposition here? Is it everybody, citizen resident getting a certain amount, like you mentioned, like $1,000 a month or something like that? How does that work? What is the proposal?
Yeah, thank you for. I should have clarified that. Of course, there's a spectrum of proposals, but most proponents of UBI tend to agree on these principles, which is it's universal, meaning it's paid to every adult in the society. Without any requirement or qualification. Okay. So you get it for being alive. And so a millionaire, a person making $1 million a year would get the $1,000 a month. Someone worth $10 million would get it, and someone who's currently on welfare, their welfare would be reduced or eliminated, and they would receive UBI and as a substitution. And so, again, there's a lot of different proposals out there, but in general, it doesn't include healthcare unless healthcare is already universal. So, in other words, in the European countries that have universal healthcare already, then UBI is an additional cash payment on top of the entitlements that their citizens already receive. And in the U.S., it's generally proposed for everyone from the age of 18 and on. In other words, it's children and youth would not receive $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. And so obviously we'd have to keep our child welfare programs in place to provide for those, for children and young people. And then most people don't see UBI as replacing Medicare and retiree programs. And so those would stay on the books as well. So we're really talking about people from 18 to 62, essentially, as receiving the $1,000 a month as sort of the basic minimum to continue surviving or continue their consumption.
Now, would this be provided to people who even currently have a job?
Yes, it would be to everyone. Mm. And so the proponents can feel that the cost will be lower because, of course, if you're making $100,000 a year already and you earn another $12,000, you're going to pay tax on that. And so much of that UBI that you receive will be paid in taxes. And of course, tax rates vary around the world. So in Scandinavian countries, maybe 60 to 65% of that UBI would be recovered via higher taxes. In the U.S., it might be 35% roughly if you're a high wage earner, plus state income tax, which in California is 10%. So we're talking maybe 45% recovered. But, you know, it doesn't mean 100% clawback. So it's still going to cost money, even if the people who are doing very well pay a substantial chunk of it back in higher taxes.
Mm-hmm. And so the effect you're saying on the debt, the national debt, would be in the U.S. to have it increase by approximately $1 trillion per year?
Yeah, I think that's a very good estimate, with the idea being that the total program cost would be somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion, but that some of those costs would be lowered by higher tax revenues from people like we discussed that have substantial income from other sources. And also the replacement of a certain amount of welfare and entitlements, which are currently being paid to people between 18 and 62. So that's $1 trillion. And if we're looking at $1 trillion deficit now in so-called good times, then what kind of pressure is that going to place on the system to borrow another trillion? And it's entirely likely that after everything is said and done, it might even be $1.5 trillion. So you're talking about doubling the deficit, and the total federal deficit would then start being at rates which are extraordinary. In other words, if the U.S. GDP is anticipated to hit $20 trillion in the next year or so, we're talking about a deficit, annual deficit of 10% of GDP every year. And I don't think there's any historical precedent for people claiming that that's sustainable. Unless you're going to raise another, you're going to pay for this with tax revenues. You know, you're going to raise another trillion a year in taxes. And so I have a couple of charts here that speak to that, which I believe is magical thinking. I think that's fantasy. I think that the reality is taxes have only risen because of this enormous stimulus that has been placed in the economy by central bank policy and fiscal stimulus and so on. And you've probably seen charts which show that if we subtract federal deficit spending, then GDP has been negative for much of the last 9 years. In other words, scrape away the stimulus and the organic economy, is not growing. It's stagnating, and profits are stagnating, wages are stagnating, the tax base is stagnating. I have two charts here that show the fundamental problem is you can't raise taxes and have that sustainable unless you have a growing, you know, expanding business sector and you have rising productivity. And so this, of course, held true through the 1950s and 60s. And that's why that's considered a golden era of widespread prosperity is there were new businesses expanding, existing businesses were expanding, and productivity was considerably higher, as much as 4 or 5% annual growth. And as these two charts show, business new growth of the birth of new businesses mm-hmm. has basically collapsed. And it's collapsed for years, okay? And then we have productivity's collapsed as well. And the reason why people have trouble understanding this is when we automation isn't really boosting productivity, at least not yet, and it may never. What it does is it substitutes automation for human labor. So it boosts profits by eliminating the human workers' expenses, but it doesn't boost the productivity. And that's what this chart of productivity shows.
I see. And I guess on the cost of this UBI, we haven't even talked about the increase in the servicing of that debt, right? Especially with rising interest rates as the trend in the U.S., the debt servicing costs would also escalate as well.
That's an excellent point, Richard. And so let's say if we're talking about a minimum additional expense of $1 trillion and interest rates, say, eventually normalize to, say, a government bond has an interest rate of 4 or 5%, very quickly that's going to add up to $500 billion more per year in interest payments on this skyrocketing debt.
And just thinking about this overall, would this not add some level of inflation as everybody has sort of more money, so to speak? Would that possibly be an effect also of UBI?
Yeah, I think that's a very insightful point because a lot of people are looking at have been expecting inflation, and yet there's been these deflationary forces such as technology typically lowers the price of goods and services. So that's a deflationary effect. But what's really happened, Richard, if we want to kind of burrow down, is that so much of the economic gains has gone to the top few percent of our economy. And those people can't spend that money. In other words, the top, say 5% to 1% and up, they've accumulated the vast majority of the gains in the last 9 years, and those people tend to just invest those funds, right? Because they can only spend so much money on vacations and trips and luxury cars and so on.
Yeah.
And so you're right, because UBI would funnel $1 trillion into households, much of that, not all of it, of course, but to the bottom, say 95% of households, that would fund an immediate burst in consumption. And that consumption could very well heat up core inflation. You know, food, rent, energy, the basic items of household consumption.
Mm-hmm. And looking around globally, has there been any success to experiments in UBI to date?
Right. I am not an expert. I'm not an academic who spends all my time researching current efforts on testing UBI. Mm-hmm. But just reading the public sources in the media, there have been some small-scale experiments in Finland and other places, including North America. And what, to the best of my knowledge, in other words, the best reporting I've been able to find, what they've found is that people are very happy with this at first. But then over time, say if you look at their life over the next year or two, mm-hmm. they've found that they don't really change anything. In other words, the people aren't better off. They don't really end up having any more money to invest. Yeah. And that they actually sort of pursue what I call like dilettante kind of behaviors. In other words, they go, oh, wow, now I can go back to school. And so they go back to school and then they do that for 3 months and they switch their majors and they discover the second thing they were going to study wasn't really that fun. And so all it does is support what I would call like dilettante churn. And of course, those of us who know people with trust funds, we're familiar with this because trust funders in the main never really accomplish much, you know, because they don't have to. Mm-hmm. There's no pressure on them whatsoever to perform or finish anything. And so they tend to drift around and spend a lot of time getting counseling and getting depressed and being in therapy and, you know, pursuing sort of art projects and that kind of thing.
Wow.
And, you know, I don't want to sound too harsh, but this is what I've observed myself in the real world. And if you look at people on regular welfare, where the payments for a household are well above $1,000 in most of the United States, we already have a test cohort of people earning or receiving money for not doing any work. And do we find that they're like successful and happy? And the answer is, well, actually, no. If you look at this participation rate of males, I think it's tied directly to the opioid crisis. When people get $1,000 a month, but they have no work, no purpose, no positive social role, they spiral down into depression because it's not human. We need to be active and needed in our community, and just giving people some free money doesn't really meet our most profound human needs.
Yeah, exactly. One of your charts is on the civilian labor force participation rate, and you've got some notes in there indicating sort of points in time when you see that automation was starting to eat into the middle class jobs about 2009-ish or so, 2010. And then since then, there's been diminishing returns on financialization. So what is the answer if not UBI? I mean, is there approach to providing as many people, you know, productive work that they're happy to do? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, thank you for asking that, because I'm going to stretch out and go into territory that's kind of beyond the conventional understanding of economics, which is typically it's like there's socialism and there's capitalism. And so there's the left and the right. And so there's the state. In other words, the government is going to solve everything, or the market's going to solve everything. And so in my analysis, the kinds of problems we're looking at here with wealth and income inequality and the loss of paid work, I don't think either the market or the state can solve this. In other words, UBI is the approach of the left, and basically the idea that the state will collect money from the private sector and it will redistribute it to everyone equally through UBI, and that will solve both of these problems. Mm-hmm. And that's really not the case. It's not enough money, and it doesn't meet people's most profound needs. And if you want to be a little more cynical, I have a chart here that shows debt by age. And you can see that the people under 35 have very high debt levels because of the student loans. They were promised good paying jobs if they only invested $100,000 of borrowed money in a mostly worthless university diploma. So you can foresee that what's going to happen to the UBI $1,000 a month, much of it's going to be spent on debt service, on student loans and other auto loans and existing credit card debt, which is typically taken on by people who have a lot of debt and their income stretched already. So what we're really looking at is UBI is just a way to fund the lenders. In other words, it's a way of allowing all these tens of millions of borrowers to service their existing debts. It's not really for the benefit of the recipients. It's really just a way to keep the whole debt bubble afloat. And I think that's true. So to back to your original question, I think we need a third system here. We need a third part of the economy, not a replacement of the market, not a replacement of the state, but a new sector, which I call the community economy, which funds work performed that's in your community that meets the scarcities in each community. And this is what I see as the problem with centralization and central governments is they have these broad brush programs, like let's just throw $1,000 at everybody. That's not really solving the problems within each community, which is localized, and it doesn't respond to centralized solutions. You know, in other words, it should be up to each community to pick the projects that would benefit the community the most, and then put the people to work doing this. And what a lot of people don't understand about automation and robotics is it only works in a certain number of very specific things. In other words, a factory that's going to put out the same amount of the same product in endless supplies, right? It works. Robotics works well there. But in terms of restoring habitats or planting trees in neighborhoods, you could at great expense get a robot that, you know, can search out every barren piece of dirt and plant something. But it's not cost effective and no one's making a profit from it. So we might as well pay people to do that.
Yeah. And I guess finally, a question on what everybody would say as the counter argument, and that is that, well, if software automation comes and robotics automation comes and artificial intelligence comes, that can help release time for human labor and other endeavors to address other, you know, challenges in the economy, perhaps in energy, perhaps in the environment. What are your thoughts on that? Could that take place, or is that taking place?
Yeah, that's a great topic, Richard. And I think we can all anticipate the freeing of human drudgery, you know, with automation and robotics and AI. And that is a very positive thing, which I think is happening, but it's not happening equally throughout the economy. So it's quite lumpy, you know, a lot of the proponents of UBI foresee everybody becoming an artist or a poet or something. And I think that that's unrealistic, because that kind of behavior is not really rewarding, because it doesn't create a positive social role. But it also overlooks that a lot of our communities could use human touch. And in my books, I talk about high touch and low touch. And technology is like low touch. There's no value to the human touch in a manufacturing position. But when you're talking about dealing with people, like checking in on elderly people or enriching the education of young people, then the human touch turns out to be extremely important, the so-called high-touch labor. So we have to be careful and realize automation is only going to replace low-touch work. You know, like you don't mind if you're in a hospital, you won't mind a robot coming in to deliver your pills, but you still want a human being to come in and express some concern and care for you.
Yeah. Wow. Great insight from Charles here. And I guess so people can read your book to find more insight, more information. And how else can our listeners learn more about your work, Charles?
Yeah, well, please visit oftwominds.com, go to the blog page, and you'll see that I have the first two chapters of my latest book, Money and Work Unchained, on these exact topics we're discussing. It's free. Just download the PDF and take it from there.
Great. Thank you very much, Charles, for being on the podcast show. Thank you.
Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.